Right, I'm Claire Coyne. I'm interviewing Ron Hartnell on Thursday, the 20th of November, 2014, at his home on Gibson's Hill. So, Ron, I've introduced you, but if you could introduce yourself and also give your year of birth, please.
Okay, well, I'm Ron Hartnell. I was born in 1933 in Battersea.
Great. And could you just tell me briefly what your mother and father did during their working lives?
My father was sort of the second or third generation interior decorator, but he worked for a firm in the West End who owned property. So he was maintaining properties such as Eaton Square, which is where he worked quite a lot up there. And in consequence, he got involved in some quite big jobs. He got involved with the interior decorations of Blenheim Palace at the time. In fact, we moved down there when I was about four. I spent a whole summer living down there while you worked there. And he was also responsible for the painting of the then new Chelsea Bridge as well. You know, almost like a chemist mixing all the stuff there. My mother didn't work as such, although she passed a civil service exam when she was about 18, but her father wouldn't let her follow it up. So she's had various jobs.
That's lovely, thank you. And just briefly again, if you list the schools that you went to.
We started school at the age of three. The school was Shaftesbury Estate, Holden Street School. The Shaftesbury Estate was an estate built by the Earl of Shaftesbury in the 1870s for artisan workers, and it was considered to be far ahead of its time. You had almost indoor toilets. You go out the back door and you have a toilet. And you had running cold water, which was quite a thing in the 1870s. So we had three generations of Hartnells there. I've got evidence of my grandparents were there in the 1901 census, and my father lived there with them until he got married in 1930 to my mother, and they lived there until he died in 1938. But my mother still lived there during the war. She was bombed out, or I was with her, bombed out twice. So we had quite a hectic life at certain stages.
Well, I'll come back to that definitely. Before we move on to talk about the Temple of Mithras site specifically and your visit there, could you just tell me in one or two sentences what you did mainly for your working life?
I left school at 16 with matriculation, but I couldn't go to university because we couldn't afford it. So I went to work for the then biggest insurance company in the world, the Royal. They had a branch at Clapham Junction where I worked as a junior clerk until my national service in 1951. And when I came out, I did 3 years because I got a better trade, as it were. I was a radar expert by the time I came out, during which I met my then wife and at a youth club. And I wanted to get married as soon as possible because, well, we had nothing. But the Royal said you couldn't marry until you were 25. So I didn't go back to the Royal. And when I came out the RAF, I ambled into the city and picked up a job at a Lloyd's broker, C.E. Heath's, and was in there. Breakdown room, which meant that you were given paper which showed how many risks they'd placed, what sort of risks they were, and you had to break it down in what you call lines between the various Lloyd's underwriters. That was quite a good job in the sense that there were quite a lot of young people like me around. So, you know, we had quite a good time together. And part of that time was we would get out at about lunchtime and see what was going on.
Which brings us on nicely. So can you tell me your overriding impression of visiting the Temple of Mithras site?
It was, I must remember that City of London, like most of London, was an area of bomb debris. There was a lot of bomb debris about. St. Paul's was outstanding because it's the only place standing there. If you stood by the river and looked up, there's nothing between you and St. Paul's, left or right. So it wasn't uncommon for one to amble around at lunchtime to see what was going on. The War Book site was interesting because it attracted a lot of people. Didn't know what was going on, quite honestly. There was bods down there messing around, you know. And we used to sort of take it as part of our lunchtime stroll and include it in the ambles. And I don't remember anybody being with me when I saw the head. I was standing up on the pavement looking down, and these chaps were messing around the far right hand side, my right hand side. And almost looked as if the chap had picked something up, and he dropped it, and it rolled like a ball right into the middle of the area, and him running after it. You know, subject to cheers, of course, all around. And that was my introduction to the head of Mithras, because I saw it many, many times in the Royal Exchange. It was, it was a precursor of the Museum of London. Subsequently, I worked for the Cornhill, who had their head office was opposite, alongside the Royal Exchange. And the barbers were underneath it as well, so it was sort of the centre where you were wafting around, as it were. And so I'd often be just walking through, passing through, and say hello to the head, because it's an old friend, as it were, because, you know, I'd seen it before. And that basically tied in with what else was going on, in the sense that the people I was working with, well, one chap in particular, his father was a caretaker of an office block, and he lived there. He lived in the top floor, so he knew an awful lot about the City of London. And we would go around at the time, and he'd point out things to me. And one, if I may tell you, in Cornhill, if you're ever walking up Cornhill from the bank, there's a church on the right hand side called St. Michael's. It's behind a row of old shops. And if you look on top of those old shops, you'll see a figure, a naked figure of a man with his bottom towards the church, bending down. I'm told that it was because the vicar upset the architect, and that was the architect's response. And it's still there. I've got a photograph of it somewhere.
Oh, well, I'll look out for that.
But that's the thing about that time. It was all open. When I was with the Cornhill, one of my companions there was a chap called Gerald something, anyway, called him G, only a little chap, very dapper. But he was a member of the Specials River Police. And so he knew what was going on, he knew the river, so we would go down to the river when the tide was out. And he'd point out things to us, you know. And one of the things that still tickles me is that everyone was looking for something new to do. And Southwark Bridge, the city side of Southwark Bridge, I mean, there's all debris and things like that. So some bright spark thought he'd put an automatic car park there. And it was all metal, it was quite big. You drove your car in, and the machine would take you zoom, 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 zoom up there, and it would stay there until you wanted it. But because it never worked. So you'd have your car up there and you wanted to get home or somewhere or other. And it's quite a common thing to see people jumping up and down. You know, so you had all those sort of things going on. It certainly wasn't dull.
No, it doesn't sound dull at all. So just going back to the excavation site, can you remember, I mean, I know you said you used to mosey around the City of London all the time. Can you remember hearing about the excavation site in particular, or did you just come across it one day?
I think we came across it. It was a place where something was going on.
And did it mean anything to you? Like, was anybody giving him any information about what they thought they'd found there?
No. As I say, it was a pleasant surprise to me later to see the head at the Royal Exchange. It was there for years. Must have been 20 years. The Royal Exchange has changed an awful lot since those days, but it was just a display with glass cabinets around and all sorts of things in there. A Rome bikini was there. Do you know that one? and things of that nature, you know, caused all sorts of comments, you know, as it would.
So did Roman history mean much to you, and did you know anything about the cult of Mithras?
Not then. No. I learnt about Mithras fairly recently, in the sense that I went to the Egyptology course when I retired. That was in 1998. They had classes in Croydon, and we had a very good teacher or instructor. She was a member of the British Museum staff, and so she got us into all sorts of places. But she said one day, I'm going to take you around the City of London. And we were passing by, and she said, that's Temple of Mithras. I said, yeah, I know, I've seen it, I saw it when it happened. So we all went over there, and, you know, about 20 of us in the class, and she discussed it, I discussed it, and we all had a good time. But we did learn about Mithras from her as part of the religion of the time, of the beginning of Christianity, which is why I joined the course, because it was advertised as being a course on not only Egyptology, but the Middle Eastern religions of the time. But Mithras was included among them.
And what was it like going to see? So you saw the temple where it had been recited then?
Yes. We were the only people there. I mean, it was sort of about 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, when everybody in the city was either in the office or charging around. So, you know, we spent quite a while there, I think, you know, a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. She was, but she's still alive, a very good teacher. Went on three trips with her, twice to Egypt, once to Syria. And that's a place. Oh, it was a place. Beautiful. Beautiful. It was. Crazy man.
So it sounds like history is really important to you, Ron, and you focus particularly on Egyptology, but how would you express why history is meaningful to you?
I think because as a young child, I was six when war started, very conscious of what was going on. And when I was back in London for that 6 months, from Christmas 41 to June 42, my aunt used to buy me the Telegraph, which had maps and very good maps of war, you know. So I had these stuck on the wall and was, you know, marking progress of various armies and so forth and so on. So, and of course, when you talk about current events, particularly war, invariably there's comparisons made about what went before. And so you're sort of drawn into it that way. And so, you know, I followed it through that. And of course, you get involved. I know it wasn't the Blitz during that time, but there would be raids. You know, there's a local cinema, at Clapham Junction, that was bombed one afternoon, and 500 people were killed. And the telegram boy I knew, he was around when they dropped a bomb lunchtime on the top of the road. So it, you know, you're very aware of your situation in history, part of history that's going on around you all the time. And strange things, strange memories happen. I always remember coming out the front door and smelling London burning. All you could smell was burning timber. It wasn't wood, it was timber. There's a difference, as you know. And that smell was there all the time. And so, you know, you cite yourself, if you like, the place in history. And of course, you live accordingly, particularly as a child, because you have to. You're in an environment, and you have to either go under the kitchen table or get involved. The other factor which affected me, I think, I'm a great, great Western film fan, absolutely. This is one of the things we used to do when we were before the wars. Faulkney, right, visit to the Saturday morning cinema at Battersea Town Hall. And so I had a great affection for the Americans. And when my mother took me down to be with my brothers in Okehampton in Devon, which is on the edge of Dartmoor, shortly afterwards, American troops arrived there for training. And they were a great mixture. I used to meet them in the park, and they were more naive than me. 18, 19-year-old lads, you know, they were almost like Sunday school children coming out and blinking in the sunshine. They were very, very simple. And they were very good to us, you know. They identified with me, I identified with them. And that was one side of them. The other side was that the person I was staying with, Mrs. Smith, would you believe, she entertained the American soldiers. So at a certain time of an evening, her son, who's about the same age as me, and I used to go out the front door. American soldiers came in, gave us each half a crown as they came in, and off we went and gathered a group of boys around us to say what's going on. I had a marvellous time spending that money. Went to pictures four times a week, and the apple fritters in the local fish and chip shop were just... unfortunately, it had to come to an end, in the sense that we were out, the boy, Mike and I, on the edge of the moors with the railway there, and we were mucking about, and we put stones on the line, and we were spotted. He was spotted because he was known by the local railway people. So we were up before the beak, and at the age of 9, I was up before the beak, and they decided, well, they fined my mother 4 shillings, and then nobody knew what to do with me. And so for 3 or 4 months, the billeting officer had to have me living with him. It was a very nice house, big detached house, just two boys about the same age as me, and a bath every night, you know, that's quite something. Eventually, they found a couple who would take me, and I say they effectively moulded my life from then onwards. There were a couple, I suppose they must have been in their 30s, late 30s, no children. She had an accident when she was a child. But they were members of the local Methodist church. And I got involved with that and found that I had you won't believe this, but I had a superb soprano voice. So I was in the choir, trained up by the choir mistress, and used to go around giving silver concerts. You couldn't hear me unless you paid at least sixpence.
Golly, Ron, that sounds amazing. But listen, I'm going to draw you back to London in the 50s, because I just want to ask you a little bit more about when you visited the Temple of Mithras site. So I'm interested in something you said earlier, and I think you said it on the phone as well to a colleague of mine, about the bomb damage in London that was obviously still extremely evident in the 50s. And obviously your experiences from when you were a little boy and the real meaning of that and really experiencing the terror and destruction. And then in the 50s, when this, you know, because essentially it was because the building was starting again, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That the Temple of Mithras was discovered.
Yes, yes.
And I just wondered if you had any sense of that at the time, that out of this destruction something had been discovered, or whether it was anything you thought about later?
I didn't appreciate it at the time, because it was going on everywhere. As I say, it was the fact that I saw the head so often, when I, you know, spoke about it to my Egyptology classmates, and told them, you know, how I saw the head, and their views, expressions at the time, and the fact that I knew quite a lot about the religion of Mithras at that time, which I wasn't even aware of before. I mean, there's a piece of religious object in the British Museum of Mithras, with the bull. It's a while since I've seen it, but you know, so there was very substantial evidence that, and I tracked Mithras through my readings, became very much aware that it was a very, very important religion, mainly because of the army, and that the Roman soldiers in Britain were members of it. And the fascinating thing about it was that I still do keep coming across it. I don't know if you know a historical author called Bernard Cornwell. He wrote Sharp, but he's also written some further back historical novels about Britain at the time of the Roman departure and the Anglo-Saxon versus the Norse, and also at that time the Welsh border became alive, and he describes a battle between the Romo-British troops and one of the Welsh king's troops there on the border, and the British troops or the leaders had brought horses across from Brittany, who were used during the battle, and Bernard described it as using them like a rugby scrum. But the point was, at the end of the battle, there were wounded, lying all over the place. And as members of Mithras, the remaining troops, if the guys were still alive, but too badly injured, they would cut their throats. That was part of their religion, because they did not want to leave an injured person alive on the battlefield, because partly these sites were then attended by scavengers, mainly women, who would do nasty things to a living wounded man. And that apparently, it was, according to Bernard Cornwell, one of the concepts of that religion, because basically it was a military religion. But if you found a wounded comrade, a wounded no matter which side he was on, a wounded co-religion, unable to move, you would cut his throat. So little bits like that you keep coming across. And of course the other part was that that temple at Warbrook must have been very, very special, because generally speaking they were in caves or in cellars, almost like basement religion, I suppose, in some respects. But that must have been really something, for it to be there with its own altar and its own paraphernalia. So it really must have been something of great value to the Romans at that particular time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just seems like it was a beautiful, beautiful space for the few who were privileged enough to be able to go. Going back to, I've just got a couple more questions, Ron. Going back to the first day you went, or the day you went to the site, and you saw this ball rolling around, how do you know it was the head?
Because he picked it up and, you know, showed it. I think he was relieved to get get hold of it. He had to run quite a few yards after it. You know, so it slowed down, obviously, once he got a fair distance. Yeah, I knew it was the head. Yes, it must. Yes, he must. I don't think he could pick it up, put it under his arm, and walk back. He would have displayed it. I'm sure that's how I knew it, because when I recognised it at the Royal Exchange.
Golly, well, that's amazing. So this was before. So when you went to the site with your mates, there weren't any crowds or anything then. There weren't any queues.
No. Well, the picture you showed me, this picture of the site, is down at the same level, but we were at pavement level. I mean, never went down the site. Although it looks like that almost looks like me there, in my old raincoat.
A few people have said that.
But the picture I have of it is a longer view. I never went that close, because we didn't have a lot of time at lunchtime. We'd have to eat, and sometimes that took a while, depending on what was going on, and get back to the office. So we wouldn't have had very often the time. And again, see, it was part of our perambulation, really. Yeah.
Okay, so I've just got one more question. You mentioned your granddaughter earlier, and I know that for you history is very important, and it's something that's threaded throughout your life. How would you describe to her the importance of history? If you're wanting to impress upon her, why it's meaningful and what she might take from becoming interested in it.
She's a terror. Start talking and she comes back at you. I think she is interested because she's asked me questions and we've discussed the particular subjects. In fact, with my other, well, my her brother, my wife helped him with the comparative religion homework. Yes, trouble with her is you tell her something and she ring up at 10 o'clock at night, "You said granddad." No, she's interested, and she's taken a GCSEs and has a strange way of doing it. She's 15 and she's taken some GCSEs now, took a French a couple of weeks ago, and she's taking her main ones later on next year. She's doing very well, but she's interested in becoming a vet, so she's on the science side.
So I suppose more as a, you know, if you were expressing to a group of young people why it's been important to you throughout your life, what would you say?
I'd be very surprised. I've done this. When my granddaughter's class, when she was in the primary school, were doing the Second World War, she told her teacher, Miss Swigart, some of my experiences. And so she asked me to come along to address the class, which was a class of 30. I got there. It was the whole year, class of 90. So I put a label on her, a luggage label, which we had on her when we were evacuated. And I sort of reenacted my evacuation. Part of my time, two things stick in my mind. One was we were evacuated, of all places, to Port Slade near Brighton, which you believe. We were there at Dunkirk. And one of the things that sticks in my mind, because at the top of the high street there's a level crossing, Port Slade, seeing either the Belgian or the French troops come along in the train, you know, the mess they were in, that stuck in my mind. I don't think we got moved out of there till July or August. Anyway, we finished up just outside Woking, a place called Westfield, a village outside Woking. They got a common there. And well, the thing that in those days was they used to make soapbox trolleys. They get a big wooden soapbox and put wheels on it and race them and things like that. Well, one chap called Bob Bonner, he was 14, and he was towing me along in his soapbox across the common one lunchtime, and this German plane come down, machine gunned us. Thank goodness for Bob, he didn't let go of the string. he did get running. And you know, it was bumpy and things like that. But I later learned that they were doing that because of the aircraft factory at Weybridge. They were after the people coming out at lunchtime. Now, I told this story to these 90 children. And I also told them about the time I was back at home in London. And I got the cane. It was a very bad winter, that winter. And we snowballed the girls in the playground. I got a cane for that. They were more interested in me getting the cane than me being a machine gunner.
Oh, that's funny. I suppose they could relate to it more, perhaps.
Yes.
Okay, well, I think we're probably done unless there's anything else about the Temple of Mithras visit specifically that we haven't...
No, as I say, it was almost a passing incident, but the sight of the head in place in the Royal Exchange, you know, reminded me about it. And so I used to talk to it when I go in there.
That's lovely. Thank you very much.